Jewish Contemporaries, Paul's Assessment, the 13th talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 25, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're back in our series on Romans. I want to look at what in my translation is part 5. If you haven't printed out my translation, just to give you some orientation to where we are. Section 1 goes from traditional chapter 1:18 to 3, I'll find it here in a second, to 3:30. We're looking at parts 4 and 5. I'm going to look at part 5. We already looked at part 4, which runs from 2:3 to the end of chapter 2. So I'm dividing chapter 2 into basically two chunks. The first part I call part 4, the last part I call part 5. So if I start talking about part 4 and 5, that's what I'm talking about. Last week we did an overview and a review. Unfortunately, it didn't get taped well, or fortunately, depending upon your perspective. So this will be the next one in the series here. In the whole section 1, what is he saying? Basically, what he's saying is that believers in Jesus attain dikaiosune. I'll remind you what that means in a second. But they attain dikaiosune by way of their belief in Jesus and that alone. Living like a Jew is not a necessary condition for salvation. That's the point that he's making. And he's making that point in the face of two challenges to Christianity. One of them is just flat out the challenge of Judaism itself, where the presumption was people that get saved are people that live like Jews. For example, Jews. Those are the people that get saved. And the people that don't live like Jews don't get saved. That's the presumption of the Judaism that Paul is coming out of. And he's speaking into that. And he's saying, well, no, actually, the people that get saved are people that believe that Jesus is who he claimed to be. Well, that's a direct and serious challenge to the Judaism that he's coming out of. Then there's a whole segment within the, if you want to call it the church, certainly the church in Jerusalem, that gets called the circumcision party in Galatians. There's a whole segment of people who believe in Jesus who also contend that, yeah, Jesus is great and you have to believe in him to be saved and you want to be his disciple. All that's fine and good, but it's people who live like Jews who get saved. It's people who live like Jews who are true disciples of Jesus and true followers of Jesus. So, yes, Jesus saves us if we live like Jews. And Paul has serious issues with that, and he confronts them in Galatians. That's in the background here in Romans as well. Against those two challenges, the point he's going to make in the very first section of his argument is that it's by belief in Jesus alone that you are saved. You attain what he calls dikaiosune. And dikaiosune is being put in a position where God is going to decree that you not be punished as you deserve and instead be blessed with eternal life. That's what he calls dikaiosune. In the first section of that section, that it's part 3 that we looked at last spring, he argues fairly forcefully that every human being without exception is under the wrath of God, deserves condemnation at the final judgment. Therefore, he doesn't make this explicit yet in part 3, but it's very clearly where he's headed. Therefore, it's only going to be on the basis of mercy that any human being could ever attain life. We can't be good enough that we can deserve it, so if we are going to get life at all, it's going to be as an act of mercy. Now in parts 4 and 5, the next section, and we've looked at half of it, we're going to look at the other half of it this afternoon. In this next section, what he's going to do is argue that what qualifies a human being to receive mercy is a deeply inward condition out of which a person longs to be good and therefore strives to be good. And it really makes no difference whether he successfully performs what the Mosaic Covenant requires or not. If he has that inwardness, that inward transformation, that reorientation of his being from deep within toward God and the goodness of God, that's the condition that saves anybody. And what I'm going to argue is, Paul's whole point in this section is, that's always been the case. It's never been other than that. When God initially gave the Mosaic Covenant, he never had in mind that it's by successfully performing everything in the covenant that you achieve a dikaiosune. Rather, it's that the covenant that he made with you is going to test your heart. It's going to test your inner orientation. If you love God, if you are oriented toward God to want to know him and love him and serve him, you're going to take his covenant seriously, and you're going to strive to do what it says. Will you fail? Of course. You're a sinner, stupid. You're depraved. Of course you'll fail, but not for lack of trying. Because you are striving, you're persevering in your pursuit of goodness because something has been changed deep within you. And because it's been changed deep within you, you have a whole different motive force driving you through your existence. Well, in this section, that's what he's arguing for. It's inwardness, not outward conformity to the things of the law, that is what qualifies someone for the mercy of God. Well, in part four, we saw where he first introduces that idea, and let's review it just by reading it here. So this will be 2:3 in your traditional chapter verse. But do you suppose this, O man, you who pass judgment on those who practice such things and do the very same things, that you will escape the judgment of God? That is, that you will receive this mercy that you need? Or do you take for granted the wealth of his kindness, even of his forbearance and patience, not realizing that God's willingness to be kind is intended to lead you to repentance? But in accord with your hardness and your unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourselves in the day of wrath and of the realization of the righteous judgment of God. He will pay back to each according to his deeds. On the one hand, life in the final age is for those who, in accord with their perseverance in doing good deeds, seek glory and honor and incorruption. On the other hand, fury and wrath is for those who, out of selfish ambition, disobey the truth and obey unrighteousness. Tribulation and distress is upon every last person of the man who pursues evil, of the Jew first and foremost, but also of the Greek. But glory, honor, and shalom is to everyone who does what is good, to the Jew first and foremost, but also to the Greek. Now, there is no favoritism with God. Anyone who sins apart from the covenant will, in fact, be destroyed apart from the covenant. And anyone who sins within the covenant will be judged in the light of the requirements of the covenant. It is not the hearers of the divine instruction who are dikaios before God. Rather, it is the doers of the divine instruction who will be deemed dikaios. Indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the covenant by natural birthright do the things required by that covenant, even though these people do not possess the covenant for themselves, such things are a covenant. Such people demonstrate the deed required by that covenant written on their hearts. Accordingly, in the day when God will judge the hidden parts of men, their conscience, by which I mean their reasonings about alternative actions, as they either indict or else defend each alternative, will bear witness for them, according to my account of the good news received through Jesus the Messiah. Now, before we go on to part five, I want to just highlight a couple of things that we see in part four that are going to be crucial to his argument. First of all, I don't know if I spent any time here on it, but it should be clear, but let me just underline it. Most traditional interpretations of this passage, when they look at this Gentile who does not have the covenant by birthright, but who does the things of the covenant, and Paul's saying, is not he dikaios in God's eyes, this Gentile who does the things of the covenant? Most traditional interpretations assume that that's a hypothetical set of Gentiles. There's this there's this set of people that could be categorized as Gentile and yet keepers of the law, but unfortunately you'll never find anybody in that set. It's a null set. There is never an example of any Gentile who actually keeps the law. It can't happen, won't happen, doesn't happen. So this is simply a hypothetical argument. He's saying, what if there were to be such a Gentile? Don't you think God would consider him to chaos? Taught it that way for years, but the more I actually paid attention to his argument, the less sense that made. It doesn't make any sense. That's not what he's saying. He's actually proposing that God could invade a Gentile's life and make this happen. It is not theoretically possible, impossible, given the nature of human depravity, which is what I had always believed. Because we are so depraved, obviously nobody can keep the covenant, Jew or Gentile, so there can't be any Gentile who keeps the covenant. But how do I answer that now? I mean, that makes sense. If we're so depraved, we couldn't keep the covenant. So how would I propose that Paul is saying that there actually are such people? The key is making a very, very important distinction. And if we don't make this distinction, nothing that Paul is going to say in Romans will ever be coherent. It will ever make sense. The distinction is between doing the law and doing the law. Now, I've made this distinction before, but just to remind you of it. There's a difference between being a good person, as the law would define goodness, to be spontaneously and naturally and genuinely and authentically good with the very goodness of God himself. That's what he was talking about in part 3, where he says, that ain't you. You're not good, you are evil. You are not good, you are wicked. You are not what you ought to be. You're perverse. You are a twisted excuse for a human being, given by the standard of what God intended humanity to be, and we can't be otherwise. So if doing the law meant being good in the way the law defines, then of course nobody can be good, Jew or Gentile. But that's not what he's talking about in the section we just read. He distinguishes being a hearer of the law as opposed to a doer of the law. That's the distinction he's making. So the distinction that he's making is there's a difference between someone who memorizes the law, studies the law, champions the law, tells other people they ought to be memorizing and studying the law, tells people how wonderful the law is. You can go a long way toward being an advocate for the law of God and know it and understand it and even understand it intricately and not give a fig about it. You don't really care. You're not really interested in the law giver, the covenant maker. You're not interested in God. This is a religion for you. This is a way of life for you. This is the flag that you fly and the banner that you bear. And you charge out into society being a champion of this way of life and this way of being that is symbolized by, embodied in, and that you're instructed in by the Torah, by the law. That's what he's calling a hearer of the law. And he's asking the question, is it the hearers of the law who are going to be dikaios, justified, not punished by God? No, it's not the hearers of the law. It's the doers of the law. Okay, well, what does he mean by a doer? He means someone who takes the covenant as it is from God seriously enough that sinner though I am, depraved though I am, perverse though I am, I'm captivated by the vision of what it would be like to be a creature who is being the kind of creature that the Creator wants me to be. And being captivated, having my imagination captivated by what it would mean to be that way, I go for it. I do what this sinner can do. I do what this perverse creature can do to do battle with my depravity, to do battle with the wickedness and evil within, and try to not act out of that evil and that wickedness, but try to emulate the goodness of God. I will fail. It will be a clumsy, faltering attempt to be good. I can't actually pull off being good, but I can be somebody who loves goodness, and out of that love for goodness is striving to be as good as a perverse, self-centered, God-hating creature can be. Well, Paul doesn't hesitate to call that doing the law, doing the covenant, as opposed to being a mere hearer of it. Or later he's going to call it keeping the law or practicing the law. All that language that he uses to describe my attempts, my striving to obey it and obey its instructions, he calls doing, practicing, keeping, and so on and so forth. That confused me for decades as a believer, because I only had one meaning for keeping the law. Keeping the law means if the law says do X, you do X perfectly and unfailingly. That's what it means to keep it. If you don't do it perfectly unfailingly, you didn't keep it, did you? And because I only had those two categories, I kept being hopelessly confused by what Paul is saying here. In one statement he makes in one part of Romans, talk about how impossible it is for us to be dikaios by the works of the law. And then in other parts of Romans, he says, who are the people who are dikaios in God's eyes? Only the ones who do the works of the law. But he means in something entirely different in each of those assertions. In the one case, it's those people who strive to obey. In the other case, it's those people who spontaneously succeed at obedience. That's not going to happen. But the striving for obedience is very much within the reach even of sinful, perverse creatures, if we are reoriented on the inside. See, that the mere hearer of the law has never been touched on the inside by God such that we get reoriented toward desiring, yearning, longing to be what God wants us to be. The best we can do is be a hearer of the law. But the doer of the law is a doer of the law precisely because of that transformation that's happened deep within what Paul calls the heart of the person. So that's a long way of saying, is it possible for one of those perverse Gentiles to actually have God invade their life, touch them on the inside, reorient their heart toward wanting to know God and love God and do his goodness, such that they spend their life pursuing and striving to emulate that goodness? Why not? That's what a Christian believer is. That's what happens to the Christian believer. That's what many prophecies in the Old Testament predict will be the case with God's own people when God pours out his Spirit and writes his law on their heart and teaches every last man, woman, and child to know God. That to replace the heart of stone with a heart of flesh. All that language in the prophets is a way of describing the inner transformation that needs to happen if we are going to be able to be doers of the law and not hearers only. Now, notice I just suggested that believers fit into that category. There is a line of interpretation that looks at this passage then and says, well, that's what Paul's talking about here. These Gentiles who keep the law are just Christian believers. I won't go into all my reasons for rejecting that right now, unless we can pursue it later if you want, but I don't think that's right. The best evidence that they can give for that is, well, look how much like the Christian believer this sounds. Well, on my perspective, well, of course it's going to sound like a Christian believer. The only difference between this Gentile who's been transformed on the inside and you and I who've been transformed on the inside, Gentiles as we are, the only difference is they haven't believed in Jesus for some reason, and I have. But before we're done, I'm going to argue that just like the law, the necessary condition for being dikaios in God's eyes is not ultimately believing in Jesus. It's being in a state that leads to believing in Jesus. It's having that inner transformation having happened. The law tests your insides, and then later down the stream in history, Jesus, the Christ, tests your insides. The covenant gets introduced into human history among his own people, the Jews. And what is it testing? Do you want to know me, love me, fear me, trust me, serve me, obey me? Well, only those people who have been reoriented by the Spirit of God are going to answer yes to that. And how will that look? They'll try to keep the law, dietary regulations and all, Sabbath keeping and all. Then later, along comes Jesus, introduced into history. Jesus now becomes an even more dramatic, an even more poignant, an even more universal, and the ultimate test of a person's insides. Jesus stands before us, I'm the Messiah, what are you going to do with that? We're going to either believe it or we're going to reject it. If we find our way to believing it, it's because we have been transformed in the insides, given ears to hear and eyes to see, a heart that's receptive and open to the truth, so that we see the truth of the claim and we embrace it and we acknowledge it and we believe it. But the fundamental underlying reality that all people of God have in common is that inner transformation that he's trying to describe to us in part 4 and part 5. So one need not be a Christian believer to be transformed, although in our day and age, typically, transformed people are going to be believers, because we are those people who have confronted the reality of Jesus' claim that he's the Christ. I think that's it. Okay, I think that's it. So let's finally go on to part 5 now. Now if you bear that, so this is 2:17 in your traditional Bible. Now if you bear the name Jew and rest upon the covenant and boast in God and know his will and being instructed by the Torah, approve the finer things, and if you are persuaded that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those in darkness, a tutor to the ignorant, a teacher of children who has mastered the essential form of knowledge and truth contained in the Torah. You then who teach the other person, do you not teach yourself? You who proclaim not to steal, do you steal? You who say not to commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you steal what is sacred? Some translations have, are you temple robbers? You who boast in the Torah, through your transgression of that Torah, you are dishonoring God. The name of God is being blasphemed among the Gentile nations because of you, just as it is written. So indeed, circumcision has profit if you strive to perform your covenantal obligations. But if you are a transgressor of your covenantal obligations, your circumcision has become as uncircumcision. So indeed, if the uncircumcised man keeps the requirements of the covenant, will not his uncircumcision be considered as circumcision? The man born uncircumcised who completes the requirements of the covenant will indeed condemn you who, in spite of having the letter of the divine instruction and circumcision, are a transgressor of that covenant. For it is not the one who is so in outward appearance who is a Jew, neither is circumcision what appears outwardly on the body. Rather, a Jew is he who is so in his hidden part, and circumcision is of the heart. It is by the Spirit, not by the letter. His praise is not from men, but from God. Okay, that's the section we want to look at. The basic point of part 5 is for Paul to assess his Jewish contemporaries. Are they or are they not dikaios? And basically his assessment is they are not dikaios because they are hearers but not doers. I mean, to use the categories that he introduced in 4, it's not the hearers of the law who are dikaios, it's the doers. But all of this language in part 5 is language that's describing what it would be to be a hearer of the law. And his whole complaint is, yeah, I get it. Yeah, you're a very zealous hearer of the law. But no matter how zealous you are as a hearer of the law, you're not a doer of the law. And since you're not a doer of the law, you don't stand dikaios in God's eyes. You don't stand to receive the blessing of Abraham and salvation. Why is he doing that here? It is interesting that this early in the letter he introduces this, you know, basically very negative assessment of his Jewish contemporaries. Why? What's he doing here? What makes the most sense to me is that what they are going to propose as an alternative to Paul's gospel, that those who believe in Jesus will be saved, their alternative is it's those people who do the law are the people who are going to be saved. So whether you believe in Jesus or not, that neither here nor there, but you got to do the law to be saved. That's plausible if you've got a whole set of people who are doing the law. Then that becomes a plausible way to think about human existence. And I think Paul recognizes, as long as that seems like it's happening, as long as it seems there are that set of people out there who are doing the law, then what you propose and what you teach is plausible. So in order, he assesses Judaism in order to undercut the plausibility of that claim. It's not plausible if all of you people who are advocating this the most are not even doing what you're saying you're doing. If that's not true of you, you're advocating this to the rest of the world and you can't even pull it off, you're not even doing it. The third thing to realize is the initial recipients of this letter are not these Jews that he's assessing. They're Gentiles. He's assessing his Jewish contemporaries for the sake of and for the benefit of the perspective and view of the Gentiles who are eventually going to be confronted by these Jews heading back to Rome and all of a sudden bringing with them all of their covenant-keeping sensibilities and telling the Gentiles, there's no way that you can be right with God if you don't keep the covenant like we do. And so Paul, in order to basically undercut their teaching, is saying, like they do. They don't keep the law. So they are hearers of the law, that's true. They are champions of the law. They are loyalists to the law, but they don't actually do it. They don't have a heart that wants to be obedient to it and wants their life to be enlightened by it and informed by it, such that their whole life is transformed as they strive to keep the instruction of the law. That's not what we're talking about, Paul says. We're talking about people who instead take great pride in their loyalty to the law, but they don't even lift a finger in their life and their experience to actually take the law seriously in terms of how they live and who they are. They're not doers of the law. So I think that's why he's getting into that, into this assessment, so that he can make the case to these Gentiles. You need not be intimidated by their claims. They are not even doing what they say that they are doing. They are not law keepers. So let's look at it sentence by sentence here. If you bear the name Jew and rest upon the covenant and boast in God, know his will, and be instructed by the covenant to prove the finer things, if you're persuaded that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those in darkness, a tutor to the ignorant, a teacher of children who has mastered the essential form of knowledge and truth contained in the Torah, you then who teach the other person, do you not teach yourself? I mean, notice already, it's only a rhetorical question, but you see this really important distinction embedded in the question, the distinction between hearing the law and doing the law. Do you not teach yourself? You are a very forceful teacher of the law, but you're not a very good student of your own teaching because you're not doing what you are teaching. The very language of the sentence is constructed to kind of highlight the arrogance, the self-righteousness, the pride that is ultimately embedded in their attitude toward their law keeping or their knowledge of the law. If you bear the name Jew, this is going to become important when we get to the end of this section. I'm going to contend that he's not redefining what a Jew is, as a lot of interpreters take it. A Jew is like a Jew. That's what a Jew is. A Jew is someone who has a Jewish mother and father and has been enculturated into Judaism and has been taught to embrace Judaism as a way of life and as a way of being. That's a Jew. It's not any more complicated than that. But the Jews are, as history would have it, the chosen people of God. They have a special role, a unique role, a special destiny, a unique destiny, a place that the rest of us Gentile dogs don't have. We're just not privileged to be able to have that as our role and our destiny. They're not wrong about that. Paul's not in any way countering that or withdrawing that or suggesting that that's not the case. Yes, it is the case. So that becomes the ground of an self-deception and self-delusion that has characterized the Jewish contemporaries of Paul. Because they're the people of God, they assume, well, if anyone gets the blessing of Abraham, I mean, it's me. I mean, I'm a Jew. I'm a member of the people of God. Maybe Gentiles getting on the deal too, but if anyone gets it, it's got to be us, and it's got to be me. So Paul's pointing to that such a Jew with that attitude. If you bear the name Jew and rest upon the covenant, I don't think their confidence in their status as Jews can be really separated from their confidence in the covenant. They go together. Why are they on the inside track when it comes to the blessing of Abraham and salvation? Well, because God gave specifically to them instructions about how you live in order to live in a way that's pleasing to God. And the Gentiles don't even have the book, let alone have they studied the book, let alone are they practicing the things in the book. But the whole Jewish culture was doing so from their perspective. So surely, if anyone is going to be pleasing in God's eyes and receive the blessing of Abraham, it's we who are Jews. If you bear the name Jew and rest upon the covenant and boast in God and know his will because you've been instructed by the Torah, and because you've been instructed by the Torah, you approve the finer things. You have much more godlike moral sensibilities than any Gentile ever could have. You're persuaded that you're a guide to the blind, a light to those in darkness, a tutor to the ignorant, a teacher of children who's mastered the essential form of knowledge and truth contained in the Torah. You know, because you know so much, because you have been committed to learning so much of Torah, you assume that that makes you acceptable to God. But you've got this, there's this one problem. You lack one thing. Your teaching is great. Your role as a teacher is great. But as a student, you stink. You don't even listen to your own teaching. The way you live your life does not reflect that you have taken your own teaching seriously. In other words, you're hearers of the law, but you are not doers of the law. You who proclaim not to steal, do you steal? You who say don't commit adultery, do you commit adultery? There's a criticism that gets raised. Paul, what an idiot. You know, does he think that every Jew was committed adultery and that every Jew stole? No, he doesn't think that. I mean, in a way he does, in a way he doesn't. I mean, he certainly doesn't think that everybody is necessarily a thief and everybody is necessarily an adulterer. But his rhetorical questions here are reflective of the very thing that Jesus taught in his encounter with the Pharisees. Remember how when they confront Jesus about divorce and they say, what's the right reason to get a divorce? Jesus, we have a dispute among the rabbis. What do you think is the right reason to get a divorce? And Jesus' response is, well, you know, divorce really wasn't God it had in mind when he invented marriage. That's really not a good and right thing to do. And furthermore, in the background of that whole encounter is the Pharisees had a tendency to take their legalistic, casuistic definitions of divorce and use those to be able to dump the woman they were with and marry another woman and be with another woman. If I can find just cause according to the law to divorce this woman that I'm married to, then I can have that other woman that I at the moment would rather be married to. And then as the time arises when you want to dump that one and marry another one, as long as you've got good arguments based on the law, you're a righteous person, right? Because you're keeping the law. And Jesus' whole interaction with them about divorce was, you might, according to your interpretation of the law, be as white as the driven snow, as pure as the driven snow. But the truth is, in your insides, you're an adulterer. An adulterer is somebody who wants to dump the woman he's with and go to another woman. And that's what you want. That's what you're interested in. That's what's motivating you. That's what's driving you. In other words, it's an adulterous heart that is at work in you. Murder. Notice what he said about murder. You may have never knifed somebody to death or shot them to death. I was shocked. You take those cute little mushrooms, their feet ensconced in mud, and they can't even run away from you, and you just eat them to their death. Jesus says hatred is murderous. I may not actually have killed anyone. I may not have actually slain anyone, but I've wanted to. I've had those impulses, those urges, those yearnings within me where out of anger and hatred and viciousness and cruelty, I would just as soon that they be dead. And Jesus' response is that not a heart that is murderous? So, and even more importantly, though, we find a way to justify it. The Pharisees found a way to justify everything that they did that was wrong. Vows. If I swear by the throne of God, I don't necessarily have to keep my promise. But if I swear by something else, then I really have to keep my promise. If I can't remember what it was, I swear by the gold in the something in the temple, then I have to keep my promise. But if I just swore by the temple, I wouldn't have to keep my promise. All this trickery, this deceit, this duplicity that allows me to actually rip people off and yet all the time pat myself on the back. I kept all the rules. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm utterly and completely righteous. So that's what Paul has in mind. In what sense are they stealing? Stealing is institutionalized into their rules. In what sense are they committing adultery? Adultery is institutionalized into their rules. There's plenty of room for a thief's heart or an adulterer's heart within the context of upstanding Pharisaical Judaism. And that I think, quite clearly must be what Paul has in the background. You who proclaim not to steal, do you steal? You who say not to commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Now, what Pharisee could hear Paul's criticism here? Not many of them. Not many of them. Their whole mindset is, I'm in the right. I'm good. There's nothing wrong with me. So to do the kind of soul-searching and the kind of honest reflection on their own lives that is required to be able to accept Paul's criticism is going to be a gift from God. But I don't think he's writing to them. Remember I said he's writing to the Gentiles. And the Gentiles, as outside observers, are more likely to be able to say, yeah, I wondered about that. They talk about keeping the law and everything, but it sure looks like they're finding all kinds of ways around the law to me. And I think an outsider to the culture who hadn't been a part of the culture that's convincing itself that it's right with God would be in a much better position as an outside critic to look at that and go, I get your point, Paul. Yeah, they're not keeping the law like they say they're keeping the law. So I think it's primarily for the benefit of people who probably are in a position to get his point that he's writing this. There is this curious thing in the fourth sentence here in 15. You who abhor idols, do you steal what is sacred? I'm not I don't know what he's talking about. I can only speculate. I can guess at a couple of possibilities, but I don't really know, because not being a contemporary, not knowing their practices, I'm not sure what he's saying. I doubt very seriously that the translation "temple robbers" is right. I doubt very seriously that Pharisaical Jews were notorious temple robbers. I mean, why? I mean, why would that be? But what does make sense would be there are several things that they were duty-bound by the law that were going to cost them financially that they had to make by as way of contribution to the temple worship in Jerusalem. The temple tax, for one, that goes way back to the Mosaic law itself. Every male in Israel annually was supposed to pay two shekels? What was it? Two, whatever. Can't remember the two drachma. A tax of two something or others that they owed to the temple. In fact, it was so much a requirement that the Jews were allowed to mint their own coinage for the purpose of paying that tax. And then, of course, any offerings that you gave in the temple, by their very nature, they cost you something, an animal, some of your produce or your crops, whatever, but it cost you financially. If you're a lover of money, wouldn't you love to meet the legal requirement of the offering and the temple tax without it costing you so much? And it would not surprise me at all if the Pharisees were notorious for having invented ways to minimize the financial impact of their contributions to the temple, either in the taxes or the offerings. That's what would make the most sense, and that's why I translate it the way I do. You who abhor idols, do you steal what is sacred? That is, what belongs to the temple. And notice the juxtaposition then. You who abhor idols, do you steal what is sacred? Who is your God? If you're willing to rob Yahweh in order to serve money, who really is the God that you serve, you guys? You say you abhor idols, but it sure looks to me like you worship one, like you worship a God who is not your God. You who boast in the Torah through your transgression of that Torah, you are dishonoring God. The name of God is being blasphemed among the Gentile nations because of you, just as it is written. Some of your translations will treat this as if it's a quote. I don't think it's a quote because there are actually several places in the prophets that talk about the name of God being blasphemed among the nations because of you. I think rather he's alluding to a theme throughout all the prophets rather than this being a particular quote of a particular passage. And so the point that he's making is, just as your ancestors, what characterized your ancestors, as we see by reading the prophets, is they did not have a heart that was circumcised. They did not have a heart that was inwardly transformed. For that reason, the name of God was constantly being blasphemed among all the nations over the earth by their behavior and by their disregard for and their trivialization of the God that they claim to serve. Because of that, God's name was blasphemed. And he's saying, that's what's true of you. You Jews, my friends and neighbors within Judaism today, you're just like we Jews have always been down through the ages. We have not had a heart to love our God. Okay, then in 16, that's starting at verse 25, so indeed, circumcision has profit if you strive to perform your covenantal obligations. Now, what does he mean by profit? The profit he's talking about is the profit with respect to dikaiosune, that is, the state of not being punishable at the judgment seat. Or, alternatively, it's with respect to the blessing of Abraham. Your circumcision is profitable with respect to you being a recipient of the blessing of Abraham, if you do the law, the Torah, if you perform it, But if you are a transgressor of your covenantal obligations, your circumcision has become as uncircumcision. Now, he doesn't mean you've become a Gentile. That doesn't make any sense. But what is he saying? The fact that your circumcision has, when you transgress the covenant and don't perform what the covenant requires, you might as well not be circumcised, because that, with respect to the final blessing of Abraham, your circumcision isn't going to do you a bit of good. God's not going to go, well, in your case, you're circumcised, so you're okay. It's not going to work that way. If you don't keep the covenant and do what it requires, then you might as well not be circumcised at all. You might as well be one of those Gentile dogs, because it's the one who does the covenant who is going to be viewed as dikaios in the eyes of God. So indeed, if the uncircumcised man, the Gentile, keeps the requirements of the covenant, he's going back to the last section where he envisions these Gentiles who are actually doing the things of the covenant. So indeed, if the uncircumcised man keeps the requirements of the covenant, will not his uncircumcision be considered as circumcision? Okay, again, he's not saying, will not the fact that he's a Gentile be overlooked and he will be seen to be the true Jew? No, God's not going to view him as Jewish. His uncircumcision will be considered as circumcision with respect to the blessing of Abraham. That is, his doing the covenant is enough to qualify him to receive eternal life, the blessing of Abraham, though he is not a Jew and though he is not circumcised. When it comes to that final blessing, he's going to get it. He is going to receive it just as it has been promised to the people of Abraham. He is, in a sense, like a child of Abraham in the sense that he's going to be blessed with the blessing that was promised to Abraham. So his uncircumcision, though he be physically uncircumcised, it might as well be circumcision with respect to what his destiny holds out for him. The man born uncircumcised who completes the requirements of the covenant will indeed condemn you, who, in spite of having the letter of the divine instruction and circumcision, are a transgressor of the covenant. Notice how incredibly ironic this claim is. From the standpoint of the mindset and the presumption of the Jews of his day, their presumption is that we will stand in judgment over all those ignorant Gentiles. And Paul is saying, actually, that ignorant Gentile who actually does the requirements of the law, he's going to stand in judgment and condemn you. Now, condemn in what sense? It's going to be a valid condemnation. Notice that he's not contradicting what he said earlier. You stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment. For insofar as you condemn the other person, you bring condemnation upon yourself. For the one who is passing judgment is practicing the very same things. There's that tension again. Why does he say you bring condemnation on yourself when you condemn people here? And then in part 5, he's saying the Gentile who does the law is going to pass judgment on you, the circumcised who don't practice the things of the law. Because in earlier, he was talking about being spontaneously good with the goodness of God that the covenant defines. Here, he's talking about being a doer and not merely a hearer of the covenant. It's not being successfully good that allows the uncircumcised Gentile to condemn the transgressing Jew. They're not good, but they're trying. They're striving after the goodness that is defined in the covenant. The transgressor of the covenant is not. And so he can validly stand in judgment over that Jew because he really is doing something that the Jew is not. He really is righteous in the eyes of God in the way that the Jew is not. Neither of them are good creatures. Both of them are utterly depraved. But one is a depraved person seeking to fight with his depravity, and the other one is a depraved person seeking to rationalize how his depravity isn't depravity at all, it's actually goodness. Those are worlds apart, fundamentally different. For it is not the one who is so in outward appearance who is a Jew, neither is circumcision what appears outwardly on the body. Rather, a Jew is he who is so in his hidden part, and circumcision is of the heart. Here's the most explicit statement in this whole section about the inwardness-outwardness. It's been a theme from the very beginning of this section, way back to talking about who is the one who's going to be get eternal life. It's the one who perseveres in doing good. It may not be obvious there, but why would we be persevering in doing good? Because we have a yearning, a longing that wells up from the core of who we are. It's an inwardness that's driving that person. So from the very beginning, there's been this subtext of the one who is righteous in God's eyes as someone who's been reoriented inwardly. Now he makes it as explicit as anywhere in the Bible. It's not what you are outwardly that makes you a Jew, he says. Neither is circumcision what appears outwardly on the body. Rather, a Jew is he who is a Jew in his hidden part, and circumcision is of the heart. So he's using circumcision here to represent what it means to be really, truly a child of God, or really, truly a child of Abraham, if you will. What makes someone truly a child of Abraham? Being physically circumcised, being outwardly appearing like a Jew in how you dress, how you shave your beard, how you behave, the way of life that you practice. Is it the obvious outward appearance that makes you distinctively a child of Abraham and therefore a child of God? He says, no, not really. What makes someone truly a child of Abraham and therefore a child of God is what's going on inside. God puts the mark of his promise not on the body, but on the inside, subjective, inner, existential commitments of a human being. That's where you really see the sign, the mark, the brand, the sign of God's ownership of you as a Jew. And then he says, it is by the Spirit, not by the letter. And I think what he means by that is the one who is a Jew is a Jew, is so by the Spirit, not by the letter. So what is it that makes you a Jew? It's when the Spirit of God invades your being, reorients you toward God, and makes you someone who loves God and wants to serve him. That's what makes a Jew a Jew. It's not his going to the Torah and using the Torah to write a script for himself. That's not what makes a Jew a Jew. If it doesn't happen on the inside, then it ain't happening at all. Not in any authentic and real way that makes the Jew a Jew. And then finally he says, his praise is not from men, but from God. Men are easily impressed. God is not. God, who peers into the heart and who peers into the inside, is going to require that inward orientation be there before he considers you a child of Abraham. Mankind, human beings, can like the costume. They can just accept the costume at face value and say, if you're wearing the costume of a Jew, then you must be a Jew. God's not deceived by the costume. He peers into the heart. And only the Jew who respects the promiser, the covenant maker, only the one who loves the one who gave us the covenant, only that one is a child of Abraham, who has the same heart as their father Abraham, who resembles their father Abraham and therefore is a true child of Abraham. Okay, the most controversial part of this, especially paragraph 16, the most controversial part is that there's a long tradition within Christianity that looks at paragraph 16 as if Paul is saying, you know, the Jews claiming to be the people of God and so on, okay, they might have used to been, maybe they used to be the children of God, but Paul is coming along here and redefining what it means to be a child of God. It's no longer the Jews who are the chosen people, the, the chosen people of God. The chosen people of God now have become believers in Jesus, Jews or Gentiles, who belong to that group, and they are the true people of God. And they take this paragraph as if Paul is completely and totally redefining what it means to be the people of God. We'll see later in the letter that Paul doesn't believe that for a second. But you can even see it here, because what's the question that he's asking here when he writes this paragraph? For the sake of these Gentiles who are going to be confronted by Jews who say, you know, if you really want to be in on this deal, you have to start living like we do. You have to start living like Jews, keeping the Torah. You have to be a Torah keeper. And if you're not a keeper of the Torah, then all bets are off. You can't inherit the blessing of Abraham. And trying to intimidate them into living like Jews or becoming Jews. Paul, in response to that, is saying, now, wait a minute. They misunderstand something. In God, in his covenant, never, ever, ever intended for outward conformity to the covenant to be the basis upon which he would consider them children of Abraham. That has never been true. It wasn't true at Mount Sinai. It wasn't true after Mount Sinai. It wasn't true through all the prophets, and it's not true today. That has never been the basis upon which someone would be genuinely considered a child of Abraham. So don't be in, if it wasn't true of Jews that they had to be living in outward conformity to the covenant to be a Jew, why would it be true that a Gentile needs to conform to the covenant to be a disciple of Jesus? That makes absolutely no sense, because it's never been true. So the point that he's making is, what makes an ethnic Jew truly an ethnic Jew? That is, what makes an ethnic Jew a... Let me back up. Within ethnic Judaism, Paul recognizes that there's two kinds of ethnic Jews. There's ethnic Jews that are only and merely ethnically Jewish, and there are ethnic Jews who are true Jews indeed, who are true children of Abraham, who imitate the faith and inwardness of their father Abraham. Only the true Jew indeed ever has any benefit out of being Jewish, is what Paul is saying. That's how he started that section. So indeed, circumcision has profit if you strive to perform your covenantal obligations, but if you are a transgressor of your covenantal obligations, your circumcision has become as uncircumcision. You might as well not be circumcised. So there's plenty of advantages to being a Jew if you are a Jew, if you take it on, if you take it seriously, if you are a true Jew. But if you remain only ethnically and culturally Jewish, okay, you're culturally and ethnically Jewish, but you're not a child of Abraham. So that's what he's getting at when he says, rather a Jew is he who is so in his hidden part, and circumcision is of the heart. The true Jew among ethnic Jews is circumcised of heart. If he's not circumcised of heart, the ethnic Jew is only and merely an ethnic Jew, and that's all he is. But Paul isn't for a second trying to suggest that the very, very different, distinctive, special, and privileged role that God has given to the people of Israel, ethnic Jews, is somehow being withdrawn or canceled out or negated or in any way nullified here. And he's going to devote several chapters to that later in Romans, because the objection is going to be raised, well, if what you're saying is true, then I don't know if there's any advantage to being a Jew. And he's going to say, oh, no, there's plenty of advantage to being a Jew. There's still, God still has in store for them a special privileged place in history that makes them absolutely unique and distinctive in all of mankind. And he's not going back on that here, not even beginning to go back on that here. Okay, I left a little time, so questions or comments or responses?
Thanks, Jack. In paragraph 16, the term in the second line, but if you are a transgressor of your covenantal obligations, can you talk about what a transgressor is? I mean, the covenant provides for transgression.
Right, exactly. I mean,
what does he mean here?
He means being a hearer only and not a doer. Okay. That is, if you transgress your covenantal obligations in the sense that instead of seeking to do what the law requires, you're willing to get around it by rationalizing how you're keeping the law anyway, as Jesus complained about the Pharisees. Then you are a transgressor of the covenant. You're not a doer of the covenant. So transgression is another one of those words that we're accustomed to thinking of. Anytime anything about my life doesn't measure up to what the law says, I'm a transgressor of it. That's one way we can use it. There's nothing wrong with using the language that way. That's not how he's using it. Because if you were to fail to love your neighbor as yourself, for example, and in a moment of self-reflection, you realize that you did not keep that law, and you decided to go to the temple and offer up a sin offering or a guilt offering to God because of your recognition that you failed with respect to loving your neighbor. Have you transgressed the law or have you kept the law? From Paul's perspective, that person has kept the law. He's failed at goodness. He's failed at love. He hasn't been loving and good in the way that the law prescribes. But he has recognized that he hasn't and has honored the fact that he recognized that he hasn't by doing what God said to do when you recognize that you haven't been good like the law says to be. That's a keeper of the covenant, not a transgressor of the covenant.
Thanks.
I had a question about the place where it says that the Gentiles were doers of the law. And I think that's an interesting phrase that Paul uses in there because it's kind of like, well, okay, you sort of have this picture of these Gentiles who are, you know, not Jews, and yet Paul says, you know, they do the law. You think, okay, here's these Gentiles who are getting circumcised, doing the particular things of the law, and it seems like he doesn't quite mean that, and I guess I want you to comment on this. Does he mean not here's these Gentiles who aren't part of the covenant community who are somehow miraculously, you know, doing these practices of Moses? Or does it mean that here's these Gentiles who are doing the law in the sense that the law is supposed to teach the Jews to be inward? That's the purpose of the law, is to teach the Jews to be inward. And here's these Gentiles who aren't necessarily doing the outward things of the Mosaic covenant, but they've been taught to do inwardly, to love what's good, and to try and serve God. And is that kind of what he's meaning?
Yeah, exactly. I spent quite a bit of time with this last spring, and I'm sorry, I meant to remind us of that here. Yeah, obviously, because he calls them uncircumcised. I mean, see the tension there? You're an uncircumcised doer of the law. Okay. Obviously, what he means by doing the law is not those aspects of the law that would only be a part of the covenant, the distinctive, unique covenant that God made with Israel that has provisions in it that would make no sense in any other context. So what he envisions, in fact, if you look back at paragraph 14:4, indeed when Gentiles who do not have the covenant by natural birthright do the things required by that covenant, even though these people do not possess the covenant for themselves, I translate it differently than most translations. I think what he's saying is, these are a covenant. Most people take it to be the people are a covenant, which makes no sense to me. How can people be a covenant? I think what he's saying is, the things that they are doing, those things are a covenant to them. So basically, Paul envisions a covenant within the covenant, within the context of the Mosaic covenant, is a different covenant that is actually universal in scope. And it's universally accessible to every human being. And I think what he has in mind there is the moral law. He's therefore abstracting from the Mosaic covenant that part of the law that pertains to what it means to be a good and godly person. And he's saying that's not unique to the Mosaic covenant. All of mankind is confronted by and challenged by the need to be good people. Any Gentile even knows that. Well, what if you actually took that on as a Gentile, as an uncircumcised Gentile? What if you decided, you got captivated by the notion of what would it actually mean for me to be a loving, just man of integrity? And you strove with out of that motive within you to be as good as you as any perverse sinner could be. And you strove to be good in that way. That would be doing the covenant, by the way Paul's using that. You're doing the covenant within the covenant. You're doing the part of the covenant that is immediately and directly available to all of mankind.
So would a Jew who is doing the law, would we expect to see him or her making regular sacrifices?
Yes.
For example, grabbing a goat and going to the temple?
Well, give me a context for what a Jew doing the law in what time and place and what circumstances. What
could be some of the Jews, like the Jews that Paul is assessing.
Yeah, I think so. I think they would see that. That's what Protestantism has done: is we've so made a distinction between keeping the law and believing in Jesus that we've gone so far as to say that if you believe in Jesus, you better not do the law. Almost said it. You better not keep the law, because that's somehow a betrayal of your faith in Jesus. That's not Paul's perspective. The reason you would keep the law is because you're like a Jew, and Jews do that. It's perfectly and totally appropriate within the context of the history of the Jewish people to be a Jew practicing all the requirements of the Mosaic Covenant. Does it make you a child of Abraham, destined to receive the blessing of Abraham? No, not necessarily, not unless you do it with a circumcised heart. And if you do it with a circumcised heart, it's not like you have to do the covenant, because you've already met the necessary condition for receiving eternal life. But if you want to be Jew, and if you want to, you know, be a Jew in good standing, then yeah, keep the covenant. So notice at the end of Paul's life, why does he get arrested and eventually sent to Caesar? Because he was going to the temple to pay a Nazirite vow for some young Jewish men who had taken a Nazirite vow. Well, that's about as Jewish as you can get. That's not even mandatory in the law. That's all voluntary. Nobody has to take a Nazirite vow. I mean, that's sort of the ultimate of the ultimate of doing your Jewish thing. He participates fully in that. He's the same dude that wrote Galatians. So, you know, we have to recognize that Paul is not saying to believers, don't you dare ever, ever, ever eat kosher. Don't you dare get circumcised. Don't you dare keep the Sabbath. Don't you dare be Jewish in any way, shape, or form, because that's antithetical to everything we as Christians believe. It's not what he's saying. What he's saying here is simply, doing all of that is utterly meaningless if the motive force behind it is not a deep-seated inward transformation within you that makes it all meaningful in your relationship to your Creator.
And would a Jew at this time, would we expect then for them to, what I brought up, to actually go to the temple with a sacrifice regularly, for instance, because they assessed their hearts and found themselves to be liars or unkind?
Well, you can go all the way back to David and the Psalms. I've been reading the Psalms here recently, and I'm just more and more impressed with how several of the Psalms say, well, you don't really need a sacrifice. It's the broken and contrite heart that you want. And if you got that, you don't really need the sacrifice. So it has been long, if we study Torah, we can see quite early in God's instruction that it's not really the outward form that he's all that interested in. It's the inward spiritual transformation. It's the heart. It's the broken and contrite heart. So when you understand that, you can play kind of fast and loose with the outward manifestation of that. That's a part of the culture That's a part of the religious practices that God has asked his people to build, that they will one day all engage in together wholeheartedly to honor their God. The day is going to come where they will do that. But in the meantime, if you understand what God really requires of you, then you are perfectly and fully free to practice the outward observances of the law, but you're just as free to forego it if the circumstances seem to require it. So that's why Paul can then write in 1 Corinthians, when I'm with the Greeks, or whatever, I live like a Greek, and when I'm with the Jews, I live like a Jew. I mean, there's things that are way more important than the costume I wear. And so I'm just tending to the important stuff, and then I adopt whatever costume is most advantageous to not getting in the way of them hearing this very important message that Jesus has commissioned me to bring. Did that answer your question? Okay.
I was reading in Leviticus here, and a lot of times the instruction to make an offering was based on a statement, if you find that you have sinned unintentionally. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of talk a little bit about the distinction? I mean, I can certainly understand an unintentional sin, but what about when you just determine you're going to go do something, and later you knew it was wrong when you did it, but I guess at a moment's weakness, you pursue something you shouldn't do.
Okay, I'm going to have to reach way back here. Some of you who are more fresh and on your Hebrew than I am, you can correct me if I'm wrong. But years ago, I think it was that verse or that word that they translate unintentionally was in contrast to what they call a high-handed sin, I think is how the Hebrew reads. So I think unintentionally is a very unfortunate translation if I'm remembering this correctly, because it's not unintentionally. It's because the contrast is not with intentional sin, unless what you mean by intentional sin is a flagrant disregard for the covenant. I really don't care what the guy who made this covenant thinks. I'm going to live this way because I'm going to live this way. It's a defiant attitude. That's why they call it a high-handed sin. So I think by unintentional, what it means there is a sin that occurs because it's emerging out of your depravity, out of your sinfulness, out of your wickedness. It's not because you're defying your Creator. It's not because you're defying the God of the covenant. It grieves you to sin in the way that you've sinned because you don't want to disrespect the giver of the covenant. That I think that's what that word is describing, is a sin that's a matter of being evil, not a matter of being rebellious against God and rejecting God and his covenant. I think that's the contrast. Anyone remember whether that's right? Okay. I must be right.
Thank you, Jack. So, a follow-up to the most recent answer. In our moment of intentional, deliberate opposition to God, aren't we defiant at the moment?
Yes, but not exactly. And that's what's so confusing. Because when you look at, sin by its very nature is hostile. Sin by its very nature is defiant. So all sin is defiant and hostile. But is it, remember last spring I made a distinction between being wicked and evil and perverse at the foundational level of my being, as opposed to what we're talking about here in this section that we've just looked at, our heart. Could there be defiance in my being, but compliance, subservience, a desire to know God and love him at the level of my heart? Yes, I think those can coexist. So yes, my deed is defiant, but my heart is not. That is, I'm looking at my own behavior and going, God, there I go again. I don't want to be that person. I really would love to be freed of that defiance that seems to be, ballast in my very being. Can we get rid of that? Because I don't want to be that person. Well, where is that I don't want to be that person coming from? From a sanctified heart by the Spirit who has come in and invaded my heart and changed my attitude and my desires and my yearnings and my longings.
Okay, thanks. And may I follow one more follow-up?
Yeah.
Was it Karen, maybe, who was asking just now? Based on what you said in response, would a Jew in Paul's day, would he view, if he rightly understood the intent of the law and that it's a broken and contrite spirit that God wants and so forth, would they view things like the sacrifices and so forth optional? Is that what you're saying? The outward, external
optional rituals? I think that has the wrong connotation, so I hesitate to use the word optional. No, I think they would see it as a requirement of the law, but it's a requirement of the law that can be superseded by other priorities that are equally valuable to God. That's why I think if Paul were to be living in a Gentile-less society in Jerusalem, he would have lived completely and totally like a Jew and would have kept all the requirements of the law. Why did he shed that when he went to the Gentile nations? Because he didn't want his costume to get in the way of the Gentiles listening to him. And he didn't want his outwardness as a Jew to be some kind of barrier or obstacle that they had to get past to take him seriously. So he wanted to just become not culturally distant, but culturally close, so that he could communicate with them this great news of the gospel. Well, he would see that as a high calling from God, that certainly loving the Gentile neighbor in the way that he's attempting to do by not keeping the law is in the spirit of what God wants of a covenant keeper. So the fact that he's not meticulously following every jot and tittle of every ritual and so on of the law doesn't make him not a covenant keeper if the reason he sets those aside is in order to love his neighbor as himself. I mean, that's what you see in Jesus, is that even Jesus says, don't you see that the law is not just one, two-dimensional, it's three-dimensional. Some things jump to the forefront as vastly more important than other things. So he even points to the seeming contradiction in the law. Don't the priests violate the Sabbath every Sabbath? Because they're like working on the Sabbath in order to obey the requirements on the priests. So he realizes, look, there's a tension there. You can't just take every commandment at face value as being equally valuable. You have to make a judgment. If any of the instructions of the Torah ever come into conflict, then you have to do the more important and let the lesser one go, lesser important go. But you have to assume that there is such a thing as more important and lesser important to be able to do that. So he's basically inviting his disciples to read the law intelligently in that way, with some depth perception.
Thanks very much.
Okay. One more, and then we're getting late. So,
thank you. I so appreciate your perspective on this. I'm visiting from out of town. I'm with Sarah and Will and
welcome.
The new baby. Thank you. I think that Paul exemplified this in his own life when he said in another passage, if you are circumcised, then Christ is not of any value to you. And I don't think he meant don't get circumcised, because he had Timothy circumcised.
Exactly.
In the same way that you were just stating, because it was valuable to not get in the way of the message of the gospel. And yet he goes on to say that you know, you shouldn't eat meat offered to idols, but it really is okay. Mm-hmm. If you know, you're blessing the food, it's a gift from God. So I really appreciate that perspective of there being a law that is deeper, mm-hmm. like in the Old Testament where it says to do mercy and be just. And that's what Jesus, I think, called the weightier matters
exactly.
of the law as opposed to the lighter ones. Maybe that would be a distinctive way that he...
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Okay, next week we will be back here for at least one more week. So, thank you.